This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. My conversation with Sean McMeekin, professor at Bard College, author of the new book, Stalin's War. This is a tour of the familiar territory, 1939 to 1948, from the point of view of Moscow. There are, however, puzzles. One of the puzzles we've bypassed, but I want to come back because it's not all on FDR telling himself this will work out. It's also Winston Churchill. Sean, who are the Chetniks? Who is Mikhailovich? What does Churchill make of the presentation he's given by the BBC and other Czechist agents in London that he should side with the wrong people in Yugoslavia?
Well, I do think Churchill at times during the war would put up at least a little bit more fight than Roosevelt did on some questions of strategy, but not in Yugoslavia. I mean, this is definitely a good one to single out where I think Churchill really was hoodwinked. Now, I mean, to be fair to Churchill, there was some evidence, and some of it was uncovered by British intelligence, the so-called Enigma decrypts, that Mikhailovich, who was this officer in the former Yugoslav army, who was the legatee of the Yugoslav government in exile in London, who led the Chetniks, this kind of group of rebels who took to the hills and tried to resist the Nazis after the Germans invaded Yugoslavia in April 1941. Now, Mikhailovich, like his kind of counterpart on the left, Broz or Tito, who was, of course, answering to Stalin, at times during the war would have to negotiate various kind of deals with either the Italian occupying authorities or even once or twice with Serbs or indirectly with the Germans. There were sometimes prisoner exchanges, weapons, and you could very easily weaponize this information politically in order to smear someone as a collaborator. And that becomes the official communist line on Mikhailovich, is that he's a collaborator. It's a grotesque slander, of course. I mean, his Chetniks resisted the Germans long before the partisans of Tito did, because they had to have Soviet permission. Until the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, the partisans were not even resisting. Nor, of course, did they do as much damage. The Chetniks were much more effective, man for man, pound for pound. And in fact, in September 1943, there's this extraordinary moment where the Chetniks engage the Germans directly. They actually inflict serious casualties. They blow up some bridges. And the BBC and all these other media organs actually give credit to the partisans for the things the Chetniks actually did. And then there's this agent, Fitzroy McLean. We don't really have time to explain exactly who he was, but he was someone who Churchill trusted and sent to Yugoslavia. And he just goes to Tito. He never meets with the Chetniks. He just listens to whatever Tito tells him, and he feeds this back to Churchill. And Churchill, probably just wanting to believe it, he had told McLean he basically wanted a positive report on the partisans. He got it, and so they decided to cut off the Chetniks. And amazingly, they don't just cut off the Chetniks. By the end of the war, they're really endorsing the slander against the Chetniks, you know, who in the end are subject to effectively kind of Soviet-style show trials and executed, in large part because of these communist talking points that the British government adopted as their own.
Asia, another story, and yet, because it's pressing on us here in the 21st century. In October of 1945, there's a moment when Stalin might not get what he wants because Mao and Chiang are talking about agreeing with each other, which is quite fantastic, of course. But the U.S. weighs in by saying, we will not arm Chiang Kai-shek, if he's going to use our weapons to fight a civil war with Mao. Stalin, on the other hand, not only arms Mao, he takes the Japanese army's arsenal and arms Mao. The Washington opinion at this point is a puzzle to me. Remember, FDR is gone. Truman is in charge, but Truman did not have all of the range of information. There's Stettinius, there's Harry Hopkins, there are other voices, but George Marshall is sent to China to sort this out. Sean, it appears sometimes as if Stalin has a devil on his shoulder who's in charge of people's good intentions. What is Marshall's mission when he goes to China, and how does it favor Stalin?
Well, Marshall's mission effectively is to first apply very strict conditions, as you were implying, on any aid, military aid to Chiang Kai-shek, and then eventually to cut him off, as the United States does in 1946. I mean, with really extraordinary timing. We're all told about the kind of the chronology of the opening of the Cold War and the Truman Doctrine being announced and launched in February 1947. Well, the Truman Doctrine didn't apply to China. The United States had cut off China in 1946. And some of this went back to the war years and China being really kind of cut out of lend-lease aid in any substantial way as early as 1943, 1944. Some of this went back to these earlier decisions. The only one you didn't mention, but which I just have to emphasize, is that the U.S. had, of course, also armed Stalin's Far Eastern armies. They had sent 8.244 million tons of war material, including about a million tons of motor fuel and aviation gasoline to Stalin's Far Eastern armies, effectively free of charge. So that Truman's own policy is a little bit of a contradiction. There's a moment right before Stalin enters the war where because Truman really doesn't allow Stalin to join the Potsdam Declaration, the kind of almost ultimatum to Japan before the atomic bombs are dropped, Stalin, of course, is still neutral at the time. So it made sense for the U.S. to exclude. And there's a little bit of an angle in which it seems like the U.S. at least briefly was hoping to get the war with Japan over without the Soviets intervening. However, that intention, if that was Truman's intention, was undermined by the fact that the U.S. had spent most of the last 4 years, and particularly the last 12 to 14 months, arming Stalin's Far Eastern armies and giving them both invitation and permission and encouragement to invade Manchuria, Sakhalin, the Kurile Islands, and even Korea. So it's a really kind of extraordinary story that just gets stranger the closer you look at it. And then as far as what Marshall was up to, again, as to why the U.S. reversed course and cut off their own ally in China. It's not the only time this has happened, of course. The U.S. did something similar with Batista in Cuba in 59, with Go Jin Jem in Vietnam in 1963. It's a bit of a mystery. And some of it obviously must have to do with the policy advisors who were advising Truman, the climate of opinion shaped really by a lot of influential journalists, some of whom had communists on their staff who were all kind of constantly smearing Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang for their corruption, that they would waste the money and that the U.S. Would not allow this. But there are these other strange parallels with Yugoslavia, which we were just talking about, where the British kept accusing Mihailovich of not fighting the Germans. He just wanted to have a civil war with Tito. Well, of course, there's a civil war. The other side realizes it. Just for some reason, the U.S. decided to cut off its own side in the Chinese civil war.
So what we have then, FDR and Truman, permitting Stalin to dominate the two parts of China that are most worthwhile, Manchuria and northern China, Manchukuo, the Japanese called it, and plunder it. We know he plundered Berlin. We know he plundered Germany, everything he could get a hold of. It's this compulsion to steal, the bandit. But he plundered China as well. Did he believe in Mao? Or was this using Mao to make war, I don't know, on Korea? Was he setting Mao up in the same fashion? Because there are anecdotes about him disdaining Mao when Mao was ordered to Moscow. We have a couple of minutes. We can explore this, given where we are in the 21st century, Sean.
Sure. Well, I don't think Stalin ever fully trusted anyone else, whether you're talking about Beirut and his Polish puppets or Tito in Yugoslavia or Mao in China. However, I do think Stalin was willing to use these people effectively, that is, to promote Soviet influence abroad. In the case of whether it was Poland or China, he wanted what he would call, in the term of art, a friendly regime on his borders. Meanwhile, yes, he would exploit the war to seize as much booty as possible. Of course, they had a euphemism for that, too. It was called nationalization. But yes, the richest parts of Manchuria are all mass looted by the Red Army to the tune of some estimates as much as $2 billion at the time, which, of course, today you probably have to go up into hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion worth of kind of equivalent. And they do the same thing, of course, in Germany, all these other occupied countries. They take, as they call it, reparations in kind, some of it in terms of slave labor, people they would send to the camp, some of it in terms of property. All this seen effectively is in part reparations for war damages, but also, of course, just as the just deserts of communism. They're nationalizing all this property on behalf of the proletariat. That's how I think Stalin sees it. So, no, I don't think he fully trusted Mao. On the other hand, he was perfectly willing to arm and to use Mao in order to further his interests.
And what we have then at the end is some very hard questions you ask about lend-lease. Let's focus on that. this transfer of technology and food, feeding the Red Army, feeding the Russian people, at the deprivation of the American people and the American war front in some instances, created the conditions, I think your case is, created the conditions for the Soviet Union to emerge as a superpower, arm itself with nuclear weapons it probably stole the plans of, and create the conditions in the second half of the 20th century that you and I grew up on that have beggared the earth to this day. Is that Lend-Lease? Is that where we go, Sean?
Well, Lend-Lease is a big part of it. I mean, to get back to the questions of kind of victory and defeat, you know, Stalin's plan in Europe was nearly upended by Hitler's invasion. And as we talked about, of course, things, you know, nearly came a cropper in October to November 1941, where the regime nearly collapsed. A large part of what allowed them to go from having withdrawn really the boundaries of communism to kind of just central Russia between Moscow and the Ural Mountains, and then eventually expand out all the way to Berlin and Beijing. Right. It wasn't all Lend-Lease, but Lend-Lease played a humongous role in this, especially in restoring the mobility to the armies, and particularly in Asia, which is almost always ignored. You can't imagine this empire in Asia being created without those 8.244 million tons of Lend-Lease.
The Lend-Lease that gets me, Sean, is the butter and the sugar. That's the Lend-Lease, the butter and the sugar.
Yeah, Americans are told to eat margarine because the Russians need the butter.
Sean McMeekin, the book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.